in collaboration with people like Peter there, and it's related to the question of how dark matter annihilation can perhaps explain some of the anomalies that some observations that have been done in recent years that apparently they don't have a very clear explanation. So I will concentrate on how these models that try to explain these anomalies can be constrained by other statistical measurements. So let me just briefly review what are these anomalies. So one is the most famous, perhaps, is the measurements by the Pamela experiment on the positron fraction. So on the left, on the vertical axis, you have the positron fraction, so it's just the flux of positrons divided by the flux of electrons and positrons in cosmic rays, measured locally as a function of energy. You can see these are different measurements by different experiments, Pamela is in red. And what you expect from standard assumptions is that these positrons are produced by secondary mechanisms. So essentially, cosmic rays interact with the interstellar gas, and those interactions give rise to these positrons. So when you do the propagation model for the positrons, you get something like this. And as you can see from the measurements, there is a strong excess of the positron flux at high energies, which is quite unexpected in this model of secondary production of positrons. So this hints to a primary, perhaps primary production of positrons, or a primary source that directly produces these high energy particles. So something similar happens, although it is less clear. This is measurements of the electrons and positrons, the flux of electrons and positrons, also cosmic rays, as a function of energy. These are measured by the Fermi satellite, so it's another experiment. These are in red. And what you see at also at high energies is something like a tiny excess, although I have to say that this kind of measurements can be explained well in the, standard secondary production scenario. There are other anomalies. One in particular is this 500 kiloelectron volt line in the center of the galaxy, which is quite puzzling in the sense that it's consistent with positronium annihilation. So you have electron and positron pairs annihilating at a very high rate, something like 10 to 42 pairs annihilating per second. And that's also hard to explain in normal cosmic rays coming from supernova, for example. So all these anomalies seem to point out that you need perhaps an additional source of positrons, perhaps electrons as well. There are a couple of other that I'd like to comment on.
Sorry, Jesus, can you go back? So you said not a clear excess, but is... you mean the fact that it's not very big?
Yeah, it's not really clear here.
Okay.
I mean, you can just change a little bit the propagation model, so you don't need a primary source of electrons to explain this.
Do people talk about attic anymore?
I'm sorry?
Do people still talk about attic?
I'm not sure.
What's the status of that? Because they had more of a feature.
Yeah, but I'm not sure about that. I mean, yeah, you're talking about this, no?
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I'm not sure how that has changed. Of course, I was thinking it was related to solar illumination, but that's another thing. But I'm not sure if that's more clear than this. No? So the other two anomalies. Well, that we think, or at least are hard to explain, these two so-called haze's. One that is more clear, W map haze, some years ago, is just if you take the CMB data, you take the foregrounds in the microwave emission, you make a residual map, so you think that you understand the forwards well enough to make a residual map, and you end up with an excess of microwave radiation towards the center of the galaxy. So this is the mask of the emission of the galaxy, and you see this emission in microwave, that's extra, and that is hard to explain, and it's thought to be a synchrotron radiation. So what you see is that it's more or less spherical, or you can imagine it's spherical, and something similar was more recently. Also in Fermi towards the galactic center, this is harder to see, it's also harder to model because we don't understand the foregrounds very well. But you also see something in the center that seems to have a similar morphology to the Doberman case. So they are thought to be related. So one is perhaps the synchrotron radiation of, again, electrons created there in the center of the galaxy, and this could be the photons that scatter these electrons through inverse quantum, and then they gain energies to the gamma rays, and they produce this kind of haze. Now, very recently there was this paper on that the morphology of this haze, in Fermi haze, is more like bubbles. So you have like two bubbles in the north and the south, and they. If you extend this emission to the very center, it really looks like something like this, not like similar to what is in the picture. And also the brightness of these bubbles is more or less constant, so the intensity is more or less constant. So that's very hard to explain with dark matter annihilation. So perhaps all these anomalies, although it's of course not solved, are more related to an astrophysical process, no? So like something happening. Stardust, for example, in the center of the galaxy, can perhaps produce these bubbles, which, by the way, are also nicely matched here. The edges of these bubbles more or less agree with X-ray observations, I think, of Rosa. So there seems to be, it seems more likely that it's an astrophysical process, but this, of course, is still controversial. Anyway, so I just wanted to mention this because. These were also usually, these anomalies were also put in a similar stage as the cosmic ray anomalies to be perhaps explained by dark matter annihilation. So the question is, can dark matter annihilation explain some of these, or at least the cosmic ray anomalies? And, well, we know that the dark matter is made by this kind of particles, which. There is a possibility that we can detect these wings.
Are you sure?
No, not anymore.
Okay.
But let's say they are the most studied paper to be the dark matter. They are also very appealing because perhaps we can detect them through other means than gravity. No? That's one of the things that are. They are nice, I think, because of that. So is it possible because. In this model, you have that winds can annihilate with themselves, and they can produce standard model particles, so we can detect them. So can dark matter annihilation explain the signals? Well, the answer is yes. But you need a larger annihilation cross-section than what you usually have in standard case. No? So that, well, by standard case, I just mean when you... the natural scale of interaction of these particles, it's an annihilation cross-section, so the order of the weak scale. So when you put those numbers into account, you see that to get the abundance of dark matter that we observe today, this is the range more or less that you should have for the cross-section for annihilation of these particles, for this abundance of dark matter to be okay. So what you find is that these kind of cross-sections, annihilation, interaction, they cannot feed these excesses because you need a larger number of electrons or positrons created in the annihilation. So you need something, so this is just an example showing this. So this is the so-called boost factor, which is just the cross-section that you need divided by this value, by the standard value. as a function of the mass of the dark matter particle. And you see that to fit, so these are contours to fit Pavel and Fermi. These are exclusion limits for another experiment case that measures at higher energies. And what you can see is that to fit, let's say, both of them, these are different, just different particle physics models. But the important point here is that to fit this Pavel and Fermi, you need something like 1,000 or so of these boost factors. So the first thing is you need a higher annihilation cross-section. The second thing is that you have to be able to annihilate only into, you have to somehow suppress the annihilation into, for example, antiprotons and protons, because this is something that Pamela also measures, so the same experiment measures this flux, this cosmic ray antiprotons and protons, and they don't see any kind of excess. So these are again, this time they are secondary, so antiprotons and protons can be very well reproduced by just secondary production methods. So you don't need an additional source of them. So you have to be able to suppress those annihilation channels. So those are two elements that you need. And this is what gave rise to the idea of, well, first have to get this large annihilation cross-section. This is where the Sommerfeld enhancement comes into play. So just briefly, I'm sure many of you have heard about this. So just briefly, it's just a classical analog of this, phenomenon. This, you think about the cross-section of a star. You have a particle here that is traveling to the star. Let's say we switch off our gravity for a moment, then the cross-section is just the geometrical cross-section of the star. So the probability of interaction of that particle to that star is given by the area, essentially, of that star. But once you switch off gravity, because of its attractive interaction, it increases the cross-section. And of course, the lower the velocity, the higher is the cross-section. So you can just, by assuming conservation of energy and momentum, you can just compute this, and you can see that the cross-section gets increased over the case without gravity, and it just depends on the velocities, inverse of the velocity squared. So the Sommerfeld enhancement is can be understood as an analog of this, but instead of gravity, you have a new force. Perhaps newer can be actually, for example, one of the W bosons. So you have the annihilation particles, they interact, and prior to the annihilation, they interchange this new force carrier, so they interact with this new force, and this interaction creates this enhancement in the cross section. Later, once they annihilate, they usually annihilate into this new force, which is for example, you can think of this as a Scalar boson, and then this one decays into the standard model particles. So this is a nice way of, through the interaction of the particles before the annihilation, of enhancing the annihilation itself, the cross-section for annihilation. So in this way, you can have this enhancement to the cross-section, and you also can, if you are smart enough to pick this new force carrier, if you choose it in a way that its mass is less than 2 times the mass of the proton, then you forbid the decay into antiprotons and protons. And that could explain this other fact that you don't see this excess in the flux ratio of, in the protons and antiprotons in the cosmic ray. So at the same time, you could solve both of those issues that I mentioned before. Because the enhancement is just given by the probability, well, you can think of this, just the probability of the it is just the wave function, so the probability of the particles being far away, or in the Umbertor case, the particles at zero, no, once the annihilation takes place. So just to give a generic idea of how this looks like, so you can take just a simplified case where the interaction is given just by a Yukawa potential, and all you need then is just the Schrödinger equation. You solve it in the non-relativistic case. You put the Yukawa interaction, and you can solve it to get the Sommerfeld enhancement to the cross section. So when you approximate the mass of the force carried to zero, this is just the Coulomb interaction here, and you can solve this analytically. This is just to give you an idea of how it looks like. This, the solution is analytical. And you see that if the velocities, sorry, beta is just the relative velocities of the particles, beta is much smaller than the coupling strength, which is here given by the interaction of the potential, then your solvent enhancement scales as 1 over b over the velocity. More general, you have to solve that equation numerically. So this is what was done here by Atanasi in 2009. It's just an example. So this is the Sommerfeld boost as a function of the mass of the dark matter particle. These lines are lines at different velocities, again relative velocities. This is the coupling constant, the mass of the force carrier. And you see that at very large velocities, where you also have, you essentially have no enhancement. Again, this, you can understand this by this classical analog. And as you increase the velocities, well, the enhancement increases. Sorry, as you decrease the velocities, the enhancement increases. And you also develop these resonances for certain values of the particle mass. So this is what happens. You have this general behavior. When the velocities are larger than this quantity, you have the Coulomb case, so you have that behavior. But once the velocities drop below some combination of the parameters, then you actually get close to these resonances because you form these bound states. Why? Because just quickly, because when you have this combination and you put it into the Schrödinger equation and you expand the potential, you essentially expand this exponential in terms of R, and then you see that the leading to the factor that matters the most, that equation looks or has the same form as the hydrogen atom equation. So that tells you that there exists these bound states in these solutions to that equation. So this close to these bound states, the enhancement really gets very high. And this is just an important point that I want to make here, that the Sommerfeld enhancement is capable of producing something very, very large just by getting sufficiently close to these resonances. There is, of course, a point here that these bound states, I mean, they have a finite lifetime, so they will decay eventually. And because they decay, then the Sommerfeld saturates, the enhancement saturates at certain velocity. So you cannot really get as large as you want. Anyway, this just shows also the behavior of the enhancement. So this is just a density contour of the enhancement. These are the parameters of the Yukawa interaction. And you see that the enhancement is very large when the coupling constant is very large, as you would expect. And also when the combination of these two gets sufficiently large, you get those resonances that you can appreciate here.
Jesus, can you maybe explain why you're getting a series of resonances? Because in principle, once you crank up your dark matter mass, you can always go into a bound state. So that doesn't explain you why you get this whole sequence. So.
You mean this difference?
No, I mean you get a series of spikes, right?
This?
Yes.
Ah, yeah, but the two...
But you can go into the bound state above the certain dark matter mass always, given a mediator mass.
Yes. No, I mean... I think the answer is the two resonance is really just set by this. As you said, you set the mass of the dark matter particle, and then the first state, which is just n equals 1, sets you the value of this resonance.
Oh, so you're recombining into different levels of
yes,
your atom. So.
So that's the Sommerfeld enhancement, and as you can see, it's a very elegant way of producing these large annihilation cross sections. But of course, you have to be careful in the sense that those large cross sections can also violate certain constraints, and one of them is related to the Rayleigh density. This is a fact that was originally neglected. People thought that because in the early universe the particles have typically very high velocities, so you expect this enhancement to be very small, and then you would perhaps think that that has no effect on the Rayleigh density. So the first constraint that I want to talk about is related to this, and to show that actually that's not true. So the Rayleigh density, how do you calculate the Rayleigh density? You take the Boltzmann equation, which gives you the evolution of the phase space distribution function of particles of different species. And you have here just the expansion of the universe that, of course, affects n, the chi is just the density of particles. This just gives the expansion factor, the fact that the universe is expanding. You have annihilation, that's why you have the minus here, and you have creation of those particles when the temperatures are high enough. You can create them, and that's when those particles were in equilibrium with the rest of particles in the universe. So you can take that equation and solve it. You just have to change, well, it's convenient to change the variables x and y, and x is just the mass divided by the temperature, y is just the number density divided by the entropy density. So this is just, you can think of this just as the number of particles per moving volume. You can see that this is equivalent to that. So once you do that change of variables, this is the equation you get. You can solve this thing, and usually what you do is to divide the solution in two parts. So and the division is happens at this freeze-out epoch, which is just the time when you can think of as the time when the solution, the true solution, so the true evolution, the true number density, departs from the equilibrium solution. You can think of it as standard. In the standard case, so when you don't have the Sommerfeld enhancement, once you reach that epoch, you essentially have no more annihilations, and you have a fixed number density, commoving number density of particles. But in the case of the enhancement, something important happens, because once you reach this epoch, and particularly once you reach kinetic decoupling, which is something I will just briefly mention, then you get important consequences, no? Anyway, so you can write a solution like this. Again, y is just related to the number density in this way. This is the interaction, the probability of interaction. These are the degrees of freedom. Here is the Sommerfeld enhancement. Again, you have to remember this fact. Also, again, the cross section is enhanced by the Sommerfeld enhancement. Well, these are just some notes there that are important that are curious at principle. You can know that the Sommerfeld enhancement that I put here, something I didn't mention before, but that's just an average, because you have the particles and they have a certain velocity distribution. So in this case, just Maxwell-Boltzmann velocity distribution. And what you have to do is to average that velocity distribution to get an average Sommerfeld boost. And that's what this S means here. Well, this was just one, so these are just two particles interacting, and here is like an average over the whole velocity distribution. And that's the one that you have to plug in here. So you see that the case, the generic case, or the generic behavior of the Sommerfeld boost in the case of just two particles is preserved when you include different particles. Just instead of the velocity, you have the velocity dispersion. So they behave in a similar way. So once you solve, you can solve this equation and then relate it to the abundance of dark matter today, and this is just given by this same the solution to this equation. And so this is something that you can measure, that we measure, for example, with the CMB, and this is the value that you must have. So then you can see that through this equation and putting this constraint, you can actually constrain the Sommerfeld enhancement, you know, to give you this value. Now, before just giving you the result for that, I just want to mention the importance of kinetic decoupling. So, in the early universe, you have at first something called chemical decoupling, which is when the particles were interacting. So, in the very early universe, you had the process of annihilation and pair creation. They were maintaining these dark matter particles in equilibrium with the rest of the universe. But once this the universe cools down, then the temperature is not high enough to maintain this equilibrium. But you still have interactions scattering between those dark matter particles and the standard matter particles. Because again, we are talking about WIMPs, they do interact with standard matter particles. And this scattering is the one that keeps the temperature of the dark matter particles the same as the temperature of the surrounding universe. Also, it keeps them in thermal equilibrium even though the chemical decoupling has been broken before. But once kinetic decoupling ends at a certain temperature, the temperature of the dark matter particles no longer follows the temperature of the radiation. It actually goes colder than radiation, so it goes as 1 over a squared instead of just 1 over a. So why is this important? Because the dark matter particles being colder, they have lower velocity dispersion, and because they have lower velocity dispersion, they have higher Sommerfeld enhancement. So this is one of the reasons why Sommerfeld enhancement is important for the relic density. Because kinetic decoupling, and depending of course when this happens, at what time, it will have consequences for how important is the Sommerfeld enhancement in the relic density. This is just shown here as well. At a certain time, which is the temperature, it corresponds to the temperature of kinetic decoupling, you no longer follow the radiation. Sorry, the dark matter particles no longer follow the radiation. They actually get colder and colder. How does the solution behave? Just by the end of time, this is just this quantity y, which is just the number density, the number of particles per commuting volume. And this is the time of when the equilibrium solution is valid as a function of x. So time goes in that direction. And you see that at first these two are equal, so this drops to zero. It's not in the plot, but this drops to zero. Then at around freeze out, which is this time where these two start to become less and less equal, and then you can actually eliminate this one because the equilibrium drops exponentially. In the case of no Sommerfeld enhancement, this is the standard case, you get something constant here, so it means that just the Jacobian number density remains constant. But again, the Sommerfeld enhancement increases that the annihilation, so you get a reduction in the number density of particles. And as I was saying before, depending on when the coupling happens, this suppression is larger or not, depending exactly when it happens. the sooner it happens, the worse it is for the density.
Is that an order of magnitude change?
I'm sorry?
Am I reading the graph correctly? It looks like an order of magnitude change to the mind.
It can get as large as that. It depends on, so this is just a particular case. In this case, it's just the sum of the enhancement was 1 over b. And then if kinetic decoupling goes, even if you just put this case, no? It can get as large as 1 over the magnitude. So we it all depends on this parameter, and also, of course, in the coupling strength of interaction and how this exactly behaves. So this is what we did, more or less in parallel to this other work. So we just made something similar, both for the Yukawa case, more general than what we did here. And this is just a plot, again, density plot of these the parameters of the Yukawa interaction. And this is the value of the cross section that you need to have to get the right predict density. What you can see is when the coupling strength is very large, then you decrease the cross section that you should have to get this value. In other words, you can see again here, it's not clear, but you can see the resonance is there. So the overall what you get, something important is this, no? You need these values, the value of the cross-section without the enhancement needs to be lower than in the case of enhancement needs to be lower than the case without the enhancement to give you the correct intensity. This is another way of saying that the relief density really gets affected by the sum of an enhancement. And it can be as much as an order of magnitudes, or even larger, depending on which model are you considering. So this is an important fact, and this can constrain the models of sum of an enhancement.
But the boost could have been as much as three orders of magnitude.
I'm sorry?
The Sommerfeld enhancement in the galaxy was as much as three orders of magnitude, right? So this, you decrease it by an order of magnitude, but it's still that's your...
The thing is that this is an integral quantity, no? Once you put it in the relic density, so it's... You are constraining the evolution of this enhancement over since the early universe until today.
Sure, yeah.
So even when the Sommerfeld enhancement can be very large today, but that will not have a very important effect on the earlier universe. In the earlier universe, the velocities are higher, the enhancement would be lower.
Yeah, my point is that you can still get enhancement and be consistent with the relic.
Yes, I'm getting to that point. Yeah, that's true. So just to continue with this, so what it means exactly, this is related to what Nagesh was asking, this is the boost factor. Today, today in the halo around the sun, the velocity dispersion of particles is around 150 kilometers per second. So then you can get, okay, what's the boost factor there? And then you can ask, how much can I increase that sort of enhancement today in the halo to still get consistency with the relic density value for the dark matter? No? And this shows the answer. So it's something like close to 500 at the most. In most of the cases that people usually take is around 100 or so. You cannot get larger, I mean, you can, but I will mention how, no? In a second. This is just a similar result that shows perhaps more clearly what that kind of show. This is again a maximum kind of boost factor as function of the mass of the force carrier. These are different masses for the dark matter particle. And you see it's very hard to go beyond 200 or 300 without violating the relative density constraint. So the conclusion is that this is very important. It's very important to consider what's the effect on the relative density. You cannot just do it arbitrarily large, thinking that because the velocities in the early universe were lower, then you have no effect. You actually have an effect. Now, there are ways to go a little bit higher in models that have mass splitting. So what do I mean by this? So these are just models where the dark matter particles is thought to be more than, so it is in multiple states, so you don't have a single dark matter particle, but they live in a, let's say in a dark sector. In dark sector, you have, in that dark sector, you have different states of dark matter. So now in one of those cases, you have and split of the mass, so the particles in that new sector are almost degenerating mass, and there is a time splitting of that mass. So they have, for example, in this case, they have two states of dark matter, and these are the mass difference among those states. So this is zero, this is one mega electron volt, etc. And you see the case of zero is the case we considered before, which is this one here. This is again Hund's factor as function of mass. The solid parts of the Kuiper curves are the ones that are consistent with the relative density. So again, this is close to 100. For this case of models, when you do the same procedure that I applied, that I described before, or considering that you have those two states for dark matter, you can watch a little bit higher, and get closer to 300 or 400 or so. The portrait contours are just fits to the Pamela data. No? So these kind of models, for example, also recently put out, can give you the correct relative density. Among other things, they can also feed the Pamela data, and they are consistent with everything so far.
Can I ask you, is a split state is a split state electrically charged? Did you get this enhancement, or?
I think in this case it's not.
It's like kind of like inelastic dark matter.
Yes.
You have two states which just are split. It's not charged.
So why are you getting the enhancement? I mean, the additional enhancement.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if there's a, I don't know if there's a, an easy answer to that. No? I just know that when once you repeat this calculation, taking into account that, you get higher. I don't know if there's an easy. I'll tell you why when you do this split, you have higher doses.
But also on that plot, it looks like you have points which have no splitting. Delta equals zero.
Black.
Yeah, this
black
one.
Yeah.
Yes. So this is the case without splitting. Yeah. In that case, but I don't think in this case there is no. There's only one state.
So at the low end.
So this one is like that.
So at the low mass, it could give you enough. Or maybe not.
I mean, you get something perhaps. I mean, it's always less than 200.
But it's consistent with Pamela, so that's good. That as good as you want.
Yeah, exactly. Here. Yeah. Awesome. I'll have to move a little bit quicker. So I will just mention this very briefly. So you can also, some of the enhancement can also change or have effects on the CMB. First, in the energy spectrum, just because you're injecting energy and this energy injection in certain redshift ranges can change the black body energy spectrum of the CMB and introduces a distortion. This is something we analyze. So this is just it's a mu type distortion. So I don't have time now to describe this in detail, but you can also see how the handling by injecting energy on the CMB creates that distortion, and the level of the distortion depends again on the combination of parameters, so it can be very high or very low depending on where you are. But these are just essentially very weak constraints because the measurement of this kind of distortion is not hasn't been improved since COVID. It also affects the power spectrum of the CMB. So it essentially increases the ionization fraction of the universe at recombination, and that makes the last scattering surface a little bit broader. Because of that, then you get suppression on the angular power spectrum. So these are just models with an, these are very extreme models, of course. But it just gives you an idea of how the power spectrum of CMB changes because of this. And from them you can also get, depending on what's the fraction of this energy injection that goes directly into ionizing and heating the surrounding medium, you can get constraints on the boost factor. So again, this M series of the order of the mass of the force carrier, this is the kind of constraints you get. So again, it's very hard to go beyond 1,000 or so. So to end the talk, I would like to describe this other work that we did on another potential source of that can constrain the solar enhancement models, and it actually turned out to be even more powerful than the previous. So in this case, we wanted to compute what's the cosmic background radiation from dark matter annihilation. So this is just, so you have the dark matter in the universe in the different structures, and they can produce photons because of the annihilation, and those photons propagate towards us. So from the past, they come towards us, and then they produce this radiation, something similar to the CMB, but at higher energies. So this is what we wanted to compute. And this depends, of course, on the how dark matter clusters, and also how you put, or how you treat the particle physics part of the signal, also the particle physics model. So you can think of these as two separate components. One just related to this particle physics part, and another one is astrophysical factor that depends on how dark matter clusters in the universe. So just briefly to give you an idea of how the photons are produced that give rise to this radiation. So these are just mechanisms. You can directly have photons from the annihilation by these three mechanisms. So this is just that dark matter going, for example, to quarks, antiquarks, then they hadronize, they produce pions, and they decay to produce the gammas. You can also have direct annihilation into gammas, and that's of course a very nice signature, because this will give you a line, which is related to the mass of the dark matter particles. So these are, you can think of them as the photons come directly from the annihilation process. You can also scatter photons in other background fields. So for example, the CMB, the CMB photons interact with these, for example, the CMB photons, low energy interact with the electrons and the positrons that come from the annihilation, and then they gain energy. So you have, you essentially remove photons from the CMB and put them into higher energy, into a higher energy radiation background. So just to give you an idea of how the spectrum looks like for this kind of process, this is just the number of photons produced per energy range as a function of energy. The red line is the direct production of photons. So these are the mechanisms that I told you before. This is essentially just pion decay, and then you have this other mechanism that I didn't mention, although it was there in the figure, this called internal REM shuttle. There will be some lines here given by the mass of the particles. The blue line is this upscattered CMB photons. So you have the spectrum from the electrons, which is very similar to the one from photons, because they essentially come also from pion decay, but in this case the charged pions. So once you have this injection spectrum, then you have the CMB photon background interacts with this spectrum, and then you have, through that interaction, you have essentially, you just have to take this injection spectrum, and then you get an equilibrium spectrum of the electrons and positrons, and a new background of these CMB photons that have gained energy. So that's the blue line. So these are the two components of this radiation. Just, of course, this depends exactly on the, this bond where it appears and the relative importance of the scattered photons or the direct photons depends on the particle physics model. So this is just another one that I'm putting here on top, which is the total spectrum against, again, this is, these are the CMB photons scattered to high energies. These are the direct photons. This is a case which fits Pamela very well. So this is typical for this case because in that, in those models, you get a very high number of electrons. So the CMB component of this radiation is more important. So what we did was to take, to simulate this cosmic radiation, what we did was to take n-body simulations that follow the evolution of structures in the universe, just dark matter. And one of these projects that was finished in 2009 called the Millennium Tool, which simulates to a very high resolution, so there are 10 billion particles in a box of 100 megaparsecs. You see this is at redshift zero after the evolution, all the linear and the nonlinear processes of the evolution of gravity, so this is just has gravity on it, ends up with this filamentary structure. These are just zooms of the simulations so that you can see that we can resolve all the way down to 500 kiloparsecs and more. You still have these bound objects, so these are separated objects of dark matter. And we use this simulation to produce this radiation background. Now, the part that turns out dark matter clusters is called so-called astrophysical factors. It's just given by what's the luminosity, what's the radiation that you expect from the dark matter halos, which are the nonlinear structures that are formed in the universe. And what you get is that the luminosity depends essentially, just not to give more details, this is just the mass of the dark matter halo. So you can take a dark matter halo, the total luminosity that comes from dark matter halo just scales the mass of that object to certain power. And that has been confirmed by high resolution simulations, for example, done by the Aquarius project. So you can actually get there, you have billions of particles inside these halos, and you can compute the densities, the local densities around those particles, and compare with these kind of formulas, and it works pretty well. So that's the whole point of this. Now, of course, halos are not smooth, so dark matter doesn't form halos that have a smooth distribution inside, but there is a whole hierarchy of halos. So the inside these halos you have substructures, and the substructure of those substructures. So that hierarchy is important for the annihilation because those objects are have higher density, and they also are very abundant. So this is just a plot of the luminosity profile, so how this thing behaves as a function of radius for one of these objects. And there, in the red line, you see what's the smooth component. So this is the component that doesn't have these substructures included. And you see that it's very concentrated in the center, and this is just because this goes to the density square. Now, the substructures are these green lines. These are just different mass curves for the substructures. And just the important part here is you see that there is a suppression of substructure in the center because these structures cannot survive very close to the center. And they are also very important for the total annihilation signal. Now, this is all the way until the simulation can resolve. And you see that already there, which is 10 to the 5 solar masses or so, you have a similar contribution from substructure to the luminosity of the halo. Now we know that running out of time, but we know that the substructures can extend all the way down to very much smaller masses than this 10 to the 5, so they can extend all the way to the Earth, to the structures that have the mass of the order of the Earth. So that gives a very important contribution to the total universe. So it can be as much as 200 times the contribution of the smooth component. So let me just skip this because I'm running out of time. So this is how the maps look like once you include all these structures towards the past. So they have a very smooth distribution. You can see some local structures that are here around, but overall they show very this very smooth distribution. So with that in mind, we can go to the following results. So this is just the average of those maps as a function of energy. These are different observations of the cosmic background radiation from X-rays to gamma rays, from Chandra to Fermi. And these are the predictions for dark matter annihilation for a particular model, the model that I showed previously. This one has no solar enhancement. This is the uncertainty. I will just mention this is the uncertainty on the way we produce the maps. Just not to go into details, I can tell you more about it. The important thing is that the observations are reaching this level, and because of the scale of the masses of the dark matter particle of the order of 100 giga electron volts, you expect this kind of peaks here in this region where the observations are getting more and more constrained. Now, we also know that these observations have contributions from other sources. In particular, star-forming galaxies and blazars can also produce gamma rays. And therefore, these are potentially very important to constrain models, particle physics models, because they will give you a bound on how much gamma ray radiation you can have from these models.
I don't quite follow. Is this no Sommerfeld enhancement? Or?
Okay, this is no Sommerfeld enhancement.
Okay, so this wouldn't explain Pamela or?
This wouldn't explain, so I will get to there. So this is just an example so that you can see. This is the CMB photons that were scattered to X-rays. These are the different cameras.
How do you calculate this maximum and minimum Sapello contribution?
This maximum and minimum is just so we don't know exactly how substructures are distributed in Halos. This is just uncertainty of that, more or less. Of course, this depends on the particle physics model, so the curves can change depending on which models you have. These are more similar to the Pamela, so as I said before, the CMB part of the spectrum is more prominent than the gamma ray direct gamma rays.
So that one's ruled out then, is that right?
I'm sorry? Yes, all of these would be very extreme.
Yeah.
These have very high values of this cross section. Anyway, I think since I'm running out of time, let me skip to these ones, which are the most important. So these are so we repeat the exercise with the models that have the Sommerfeld enhancement, and we try to constrain these models using this the measurements that I showed before. So these are models that have this mass splitting that I mentioned before. So this is they have degenerate or almost degenerate states with this mass splitting. These are the kind of Sommerfeld boosts that they have. These are the annihilation channels. These are just benchmark points that feed everything that I have mentioned before. So they feed the Pamela and the Fermi results on the cosmic ray electrons and positrons. They also have the correct relative density because of this, the way that I mentioned before. They also are allowed by bounds on the CMB, so they pass all the bounds that I previously mentioned. This is, for example, one of the fits to this Pamela. And what we are finding is how they behave in these constraints on the extra background light. So these are constraints on, this is the particle physics part of the signal divided by the model. So essentially, you can just think of this as lower than 1, it will not pass the constraints. Higher than 1, it will pass them. And what we see is that these models all of them, so these, the different colors represent different moles. I'm going to put the colors here just for quick reference. And all of them violate the constraints at around 0.3 gigaelectron volts, is the most, because it's almost like an order of magnitude or so. At higher energy, it becomes less important. And this is just because of the shape of this. Measurements, one to subtract the contribution from star forming galaxies and blazars. So you see, this one is one of the most constraints, also these ones as well. But of course, you can say that depends on how the other components are treated. So, especially star forming galaxies, because we don't really know how star forming galaxies contribute to that signal. So to eliminate that uncertainty, I have put here the value that you can have of the cross-section. So this is proportional, let's say, to the Sommerfeld boost that you can have as a function of the contribution of the star forming galaxies to the total signal in Fermi for energies larger than 0.1 gigaelectron volts. So I have fix the contribution of blazars to 16%. This is more or less well established. It can hardly get less than this. So the point is that even if you drop the contribution of star forming galaxies to close to zero, the values of these different models are below these arrows here, and these arrows here are the values that they use to give the Sommerfeld boost. Or in other words, it's very hard for these models to reproduce or to satisfy these constraints. So this is the important point that I wanted to make here. So it seems that the extra background light is very powerful to constrain these models. And it's important to find ways for these models to survive. It's important to find ways of overcoming these constraints.
What is the, so here you're having annihilation into Mibi bar?
In this one.
Oh, no. Okay. But these other ones are ones where they annihilate into the
slight
force carrier.
This, exactly. These directly annihilate into something that will produce a hard spectrum of electrons and positrons. This is just the example that I used before.
And the scale there is G, on the x-axis is GeV or TeV?
Ah, yes, this is GeV, sorry. This is gigaelectron volts, yes. So the region that constrains is the one.
So you could go up to higher masses. Higher masses are okay, like above 10, 20.
Yeah, higher masses could be okay, especially because we don't know here.
Okay.
If this behavior continues, then you also have a problem. Since I don't have much, I don't have any time now, I will just leave you there with my. Thank you. Yes.
So in these tiny little Earth mass halos, what are the velocities? And then you get even more of the Sommerfeld boost in these little mini halos?
I mean, in principle, yes. The thing is that the Sommerfeld gets, the hasn't get saturated at a certain velocity. Because of this, the bound states have a finite lifetime, so they decay. So you cannot get.
So it doesn't matter so much. In
essentially, practice. It doesn't matter. What really matters is this value of saturation. How high can it be? And it seems that it cannot be very high. So this, the whole point is that, or my view on the problem is that it's very hard to explain the Pamela data. Or it's for me, I don't see it possible to explain the Pamela data. Only with dark matter annihilation. That's the whole. But that's my personal view on this. No? You can say, for example, that the Pamela data has 50% of the signal comes from dark matter annihilation, then you're okay.
So I'm kind of lost here. So is there anything that does work or not?
You mean that passes the constraints and everything?
Yeah.
Oh, well, yes, for example.
Left and the right.
No, but
this I mean, okay, you want to feed Pamela as well?
Yeah.
Then you would need to decrease these. You would need a very small star formation fraction, very small, like 10% or so. Then you would need, this is something also I didn't mention, these are for the minimum case of subhalos, so the minimal contribution that you can get from subhalos. So you would need that as well. And
That's not up to me.
No, that's not optimistic at all.
No, I'm saying that's not something you can tune. You can tune the parameters of your particle physics model, but how much you get from subhalos, that's supposedly simulations or astrophysics
stuff. Nature knows what we don't, I think.
That's right, but it's not the model parameter.
No, it's not the model parameter, but we don't know.
But if you want to be, because you're being conservative, I guess.
Yes.
Yeah.
So this is assuming from the simulations, what I get from the simulations, assuming the less I can have from substructures, this is what you get. This is still consistent with the simulations.
So that axis on the plot on the left, so this is the energy of the photon?
Yes.
So all of those models are ruled out, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Of course, there is something important I should mention. What can save the models as well? I should really mention this. So the models, especially these, they also predict interaction between dark matter particles, not in the form of annihilation, but just in the form of scattering. Mm-hmm. Now this is scattering, and this was something that was pointed out recently. This is scattering can erase the cusps in the dark matter profile, so essentially make the dark matter distribution less cuspy in the center, and then the annihilation will be lower. And because I'm taking the results from the simulation, I'm assuming that they actually follow an NMW profile, so they are very cuspy in the center. So the simulations, again, don't include these effects. So if a simulation is done that includes these effects, the concentration of dark matter would be less, and then the annihilation signal, the astrophysical part of the annihilation signal would drop, and maybe this is solved. So maybe the solution is not itself in how you tune the particle models, but in making them consistent with the simulations that we're using.
That's a very small effect normally. I mean, does that really go up that much for some photons?
Well, I mean, this is a very recent paper as well, 3 months or so. Mm-hmm. But the idea is that the cause, for example, of dwarf galaxies.
Mm-hmm. That's crazy.
Sorry?
No, that's crazy.
Why is crazy?
Well, because you'd have to annihilate away so much stuff, you dump a whole bunch of photons in black.
Well, but again, I mean, remember the saturation thing. I mean, what I mean is that these models predict also this scattering between the dark matter particles. And that scattering is like a self-interacting dark matter. So then you produce this, you erase these cosmic profiles in the center of the halos. Now, because they are less concentrated.
But what's the scattering cross-section? It's like the annihilation cross-section.
No, it's different. I mean, I cannot tell you exactly how it works.
Okay.
Because I haven't checked this in detail. I just tell you what they claim, and they claim that you can reduce the cost significantly. So you have a profile that is less picked in the center.
Because in CPM, the scale on which annihilation gets up on is, you know, an AU or something like that in the Milky Way.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not going to make any significant mass difference. It may change the annihilation. It'll change the annihilation rate, but maybe by factor 2 or something. But it won't change any of the mass distribution that anything else probes, except maybe the central black hole.
Well, yeah, I agree with that. Yeah. But if you change the inner profile, if you change the first. Even if it's just 1 kiloparsec, if you reduce a little bit the density there, that's enough for this to drop a lot.
Yeah.
Especially for these small halos that have very high densities that give you most of the gamma in background.
Well, maybe it's better. I thought the annihilation section
is the paper you're talking about, was it by Loeb or somebody? I
think. Yeah, that's a paper. Mm-hmm.
So there was something about that there were these self-interacting dark matter models, but they had a problem that they would have like instability at the center and would do the opposite. That people invented them to erase the central cusp, but it did the opposite thing, and it made the cusp worse.
Yeah, there is also that, exactly. If you heat things up, you actually get a stronger cusp.
Yeah, yeah, but there is a way that they avoid this.
Yes, they avoid this. I haven't checked in detail, but...
Make it from
sounds like good coffee discussion.
Discussion for tomorrow.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you.